I know everybody is aware of the amount of water that is happening in southern Texas, Louisiana, in that particular area. Please keep those people in prayer. I got an email from Joe. It says that they are just inundated with water, no drinking water, and sewers backed up into the streets. It floods the sewer systems, etc. So keep them in prayer, if you will. So, okay. So let's go to the Nazarene Codicil. We'll start with Gibberet Sheva. She's ready to answer all questions, and we'll take off with it as we go.
Mine is on the very last page, page 54, second to the last paragraph, talking about the sages, the days of old. The portion that I liked is talking about, and just as Adam exiled himself from the garden, Israel must exile itself from for the sake of the cosmic return and restoration.
Absolutely. I'm reading a book that is one of those ones that is by this guy that's a liberal, 15 million years ago this happened and that happened, but it's about the Jews and how that the Jews are people that are indestructible, is his phrase, the indestructible Jews, no matter how many millions of years ago it was that we crawled up on the beach, the Jews have evolved into an indestructible people. So very good. And I think that is so true with regards to so much that is about the idea of reparation of the things that are wrong in the world. So hopefully we might talk a little bit about that this evening. Okay, you're with Hadassah Mother.
I was particularly taken by the page 45, kind of the little paragraph down just after the verse. But I just was blessed by realizing the Torah was forever. I mean, well, duh. it's like, wow. But you just don't think about things.
Right.
Okay.
Well, one thing I do, and I will just say this in brief, I think most people have heard me talk about it, but if you look in Genesis of Bereshit 3 and 8, and it said, they heard, and I'm going to read this the way that it really reads in Hebrew. It says, they heard the voice of the Lord walking in the garden in the ruach, in the breath or the spirit of the day. So it's not the cool of the day. It's the time of day when the ruach, something's coming out of the mouth. And so I have taught that this is when Adam and Chava were receiving a lesson from Hashem. It already lends to that idea that he would come to them in the quote cool of the day, but it's actually in Hebrew, it's the ruach. And so from that I said, we know even from reading the opening passage of Sefer Bereishit that the Torah, not the written Torah, but the oral Torah, was already the tool that God used to create with, and the people don't realize the infinite part of the Torah and the cosmos and all of those things. So that the Torah is forever, yeah, it's forever, and then some. So
it's always been, and it always will be.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And we will talk about some of that as well. So. Adon Suriel, Your Honor, does he have something he wishes to?
Well, Romans 10, 4. On page 44.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about this before.
Yes. Yeah.
Still something there missing, I think. You know, for Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone that believe it. But it's either, is this a misprint, is this, is there a better explanation?
Yeah, the way that, if you read it on page 44 is the way that you should read. For Messiah is the goal of the Torah,
right.
Not the end of the Torah, yeah, the goal.
I read that also. The first verse, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel, that they might be saved. I was thinking, it's talking about that in the end of it, in verse 21, but to Israel he said, all day long I have stretched forth my hands unto the disobedient and gainsaying people. So does that...
That is speaking of the people. That is the people that were in the... in the wilderness. He calls them a terrible generation, and he suffered with that generation. But you have to be very careful. But just because that God is chastising his people doesn't mean that he does not love them. As a matter of fact, it means that he does love them, and if he chastises them, that shows his love. But when it's all said and done, it's like Yom Kippur. When you go to Yom Kippur, you stand and you confess sins that you didn't do, but you stand and confess these sins. Some people say, you know, we stand there and we wonder if we'll be forgiven. If you stand on Yom Kippur and wonder as you go through the service if you'll be forgiven, then you don't understand Yom Kippur. Because every Yom Kippur, since the very first one, God has always forgiven his people. Mm-hmm. And so you have to understand Yom Kippur is actually one of the greatest pictures of chesed, or grace, that you can possibly see. So if you have a child that is doing something wrong, you don't like that the child is doing something wrong, and so you correct the child, but that doesn't mean you cut the child off and say, you know, I don't love you anymore because you won't do right. As a matter of fact, what you try to do continuously is get that child to do the right thing. And that's the way Hashem deals with his people. And if you swallow the pill... If you swallow the pill that the Torah is bad and that God in the Old Testament is vindictive, etc., and the only through Yeshua is their grace, then you've already distorted the truth of the entire Bible. And it's one of those things where Christianity, when it first started, but as you started to move into 200 to 300 from the Common Era, the Christians began to try to draw, you know, an inference that, of course, they're defecting from Judaism, but they're trying to make their religion, if you will, something that's acceptable to the people. And so that means that you have to put God in the Tanakh. You have to make him bad or evil or whatever, and then Yeshua is good, etc. So we're going to talk some more about that particular passage and some things associated with that in just a few minutes. So very good. Yerba Gibora, we'll leave you the best for last, okay?
Well, much in every way. Clarified a few things that I've kind of not quite understood before. And, you know, reading this, it's like, this is familiar, but I don't understand it. But this time, it was clarified. So, my favorite part, though, well, if I had a big favorite, page 53, where it talks about the new God in Dan.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, we repeatedly turned the thoughts and dreams on again before level of hermeneutics. and about the allegory and how he managed to look at Adam, who lived in the Garden of Delight until he sinned, and understanding that, and I thought about bringing us back to the repair of the humanness and bringing us back to God again, but to bring the man back to God again where he can get to the point where he can hear and walk in the cool blue day with, you know,
with Hashem.
With Hashem. And so that just excites me to think about that's a possibility, you know, that that can happen. And I know that it talked about how we have to gather and all of them show Yehudi. And it's like, it seems like an impossible task, and yet it can't be because otherwise God wouldn't ask us to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, anyway, that's part of what fired my imagination.
Very good, very good. One of the men that is a very leading Talmudic scholar, and I'll just basically leave it at that. Has written books upon books, and his name is Yaakov or Jacob Neusner. And he posits an idea that basically is some of the stuff that is in this particular Nazarene Codicil. But he posits that even though Adam was expelled from Gan Eden, then Chava and the children, of course, that Israel is the B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, are the new Adam, and that Gan Eden is in Eretz Israel. And His Eminence and I were speaking about this a little bit, not this specifically, but kind of related to this. And anyone who's ever been to Israel understands this. If they stop and think, they may not have realized it, but it is very real. And that is, you can tell where you're at by looking and seeing whether there is vegetation around you. Okay, so the Israelis call it the green line. And the green line means that, you know, you can look at the neighborhood and you can see that they have palm trees and oleanders and bougainvilleas and things like that. If that surrounds the house, you know that's a Jewish house. Just plain and simple. Okay? But if you look at a house and it's got, you know, an old beat up car that's trashed out in the front and everything looks like, you know, a missile hit it or something like that, then chances are that house is not Jewish. So I say that because when you put the Jewish people even into the middle of the rows, in the middle of the desert, they turn it into Gan Eden. And so this is the prophecy, of course, out of Yeshua or Isaiah, where he said that, you know, the desert would bloom like a rose. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how much wisdom comes out of the Jewish people and their conservation, their technology, etc. So in some ways you can see Israel is a form of Gan Eden. Yes, ma'am.
I don't know if you remember, but a year before we went to Israel, God woke me up and taught me. Well, somebody taught me. I think it was you, but in a spiritual dream, woke me up. And while we were in Israel, everywhere I looked, I saw with wisdom how the Jewish people, how they plant, how they put their water heaters on their roofs,
right?
How they put their laundry outside. Just simple little things that they do different than the rest of the culture, how beautiful the flowers are, how right. beautiful the vegetation, the trees, the orchards, the fruit, and just I just saw that. I saw that wisdom
yeah.
all over the land.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you definitely know what a green line is. You know where they live, but I hadn't thought about it until you said that.
Right, right.
So,
very good.
Inspiring.
Very good. Okay, anybody on the internet have anything you wish to share? No, everybody's ready to go. Okay, let's look at page 5 for just a second, and we will try to see if we can't knit some things together here. Verse 2 said, "Speak to Aaron and to his sons and to all the B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, and say to them, this is the thing that the Lord has commanded, saying, any man of a house of Israel who slaughters ox or a lamb or a goat inside of the camp or slaughters outside of the camp, he has to bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting, etc." Okay? So, it's interesting that you're not told here specifically how this animal is to be slaughtered, etc. And if you want to eat this food, that it has to be done in a particular way. In other words, as much as we might think that we want to just do things our own way. We want to do what we want to do, and we don't want anyone else to tell us what we have to do. That idea has a label that has been so misconstrued that people don't even realize what they're told is actually not true. And that's because they don't stop to take the time to look at the statements that are being made and then discern whether they're true or not. Okay, so I'm going to say it like this: freedom. You know, United States is, you know, let freedom ring, etc., etc. And so, basically, many people think that the idea of freedom is not having to do what somebody else tells you you have to do. Okay, I can do whatever I want to do, and nobody can tell me what I can or cannot do. That is the biggest lie that people will ever hear
or believe,
absolutely. There is no such thing as a freedom that lets you do exactly what you want to do. Okay? Let's even take this. You say, you know, well, if I was on a desert island, I wouldn't have to listen to anybody and I wouldn't have to do what anybody told me to do. Yeah, you're right. But you still don't have freedom, because if you're going to eat, you got to do something about it. Okay, so you're not just going to say, okay, you know, yeah, the coconuts are in now and the grapes are in now, but what are you going to do in the wintertime or when that stuff is not available? Okay, so freedom in the way that it is propagated, especially here in America, is one of the most damnable lies that people will ever hear. Okay, so I've used this illustration many times, and I will probably use it many more times. You know, you you want the ability to drive a vehicle, a car, truck, whatever, from one place to the other. But you cannot drive a car, a truck, or whatever, and not be subjected to laws. Okay? So if you think that, you know, I can drive 95 wherever I want to go, I've got the car that can do it, then sooner or later you know you're going to end up incarcerated because it's not safe, but it's against the law. So you sign that little piece of paper when you get your driver's license, and you basically agree and are binding yourself to a set of rules that say you will obey these rules when you get behind the steering wheel of your car. So you can basically take this situation and turn it however you want. Suppose you got up in the morning and you said, "I'm not going to work. That restricts my freedom. Okay, stay home and lay in bed. I don't care." But you don't get a paycheck, and then all of a sudden somebody says, you know, hey, you need your light bill paid, you need your gas bill paid, you need your house payment paid, etc. So there are the idea of freedom in the sense that it has in many ways been propagated here in the United States is in a fallacy. And if you think you can go to McDonald's or whoever it is, I don't know what it says, that you can have it your way. And no, that's not true. You have a number of options that you can have it this way or that way, but you can't just have it always your way. It's not going to happen that way. All you have to do is, you know, one time get in there and, you know, please forgive me, I'm not really trying to look down on people, but you know, there's a bunch of teenagers back there and they don't care about whether you get a good sandwich or not. And so you said, you know, no mayonnaise, they don't care. They're going to do whatever they want to do. So you open up your bag and guess what? It's a surprise. So I think that this particular Torah Seder, like all of them, but the thing that caught me here is that people tend to think that, you know, freedom is available to us and we don't have to do what someone else is telling us to do. Now, I know that it is very unfortunate that people in some particular groups think that listening to what the sages have to say and following their advice is ludicrous. They say they don't want to do it. I'll never listen to what those rabbis say. That's a very, very Western way of thinking. So, if you were to go to you know, Japan or to China or one of these places where they have religion there that is, you know, the monks, etc., the young men will go and join that temple or that particular rite, and the first thing they want to do is hear the words of the sages. Because they know that when they hear the words of their sages are going to teach them how to live in relative peace. that may not always be exactly the way that we want it, and there are things that we can't do sometimes to control our environment. But that's, again, here we are with people who think that they want freedom, but they don't care about their neighbor at all. They don't care about whether or not you have food or clothes or whatever. It's just like, yeah, just keep on driving. Don't stop. I don't want to talk to you. So, basically, going now back to page 41, here, Chacham Tzafet picks up with a word that we will also see again, I think it's next week. And this word in Greek is the word telos. Now, I tell people that when you read, I don't care whether I don't care whether it's the whole Bible or just the Nazarene Codicil. Now, if you get a Jewish published Bible or Tanakh, you will follow that agenda. You will follow the agenda that is in that book. If you're going to read that book and believe what's in that book, you will adhere to the agenda of the authors of that particular title. Now, when we come, and if it's a Christian published Bible, you may not notice it as much, but there is more tampering with the text done in the Nazarene Codicil than there is in the Tanakh. And that part of the reason I think that is because if you have a little bit more than, you know, a first grade education, you can start to think a little bit and say, well, look, you know what? The Jewish people have had the Torah for thousands of years, and now we're reading this Christian published Bible, and it reads completely different than the Jewish people did. I was reading some verses. I was teaching a class over the internet, and I was showing the class some things about Genesis. I know you people don't think I ever go there, but I was showing them some things about Genesis and teaching them probably the passage I read in 3 and 8. And this one lady in the group is the group, they're embracing Judaism, but they're not Jews yet, and they still have a lot of Christian indoctrination. And so this lady hears me telling how that it should be read, and then she says, what gave you Jews the right to change our Bible? When she said that, I didn't say anything. I waited for about a half a second, and everybody else in the room just laughed and roared. And she realized at that moment that we didn't change it. They did. Now, again, the Tanakh, you will look in different places, and from time to time you will notice that the verses don't line up. Have you ever noticed any of that? Mm-hmm. The verses are not there, and you say, well, wait a minute, you know, if I'm going to go to Malachi 3 and blah, 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 then, you know, you have to go in the Hebrew Bible to figure it out. So, not only that, I think everybody here is well aware of the fact that all of the books of the Tanakh are in the wrong order. The Christian published Bible, they're all in the wrong order. Does anybody know why they did it that way? The reason they did it that way is because they want to make it look like the prophetic books, they put them at the very end. They want to make it look like Yeshua is being prophesied about. Okay, he's the great prophet. Okay, but if you read a Tanakh, in the last book in the Tanakh is Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, and the very last words are telling you to build your own temple. So, all it takes is just to change one word, like this word that Adon Tzuriel was talking about, telos, and that's this word here, goal. Okay? It's very much like the use of the word synagogue in the Nazarene Codice. And the word synagogue, every time that it's used throughout the Nazarene Codicil, it is an assembly. It is a congregation. It is all these different things, not a synagogue. But then, when you go, same word, synagogia in Greek, when you go to the book of Revelation, it says, and it uses that word, and it says it talks about those who were of the synagogue of Satan. So what's happening is your mind is being programmed to understand the word synagogue is associated with Satan, rather than understanding that Yeshua goes to synagogue every time. Now, there's a passage in Hebrews where it tells you, and most of your Bibles will say, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. Now, every Christian pastor on the planet will try to quote this verse to you because he wants you to come to church. But the problem is, in Greek, it says, do not stop going to the synagogue. So, you know, if they want to be literalists and say, yeah, every verse is absolutely literal, and you take this verse, you say, well, do we want to take it literal? But they don't want to go back into the language that it is written in, and they want to put hermeneutic rules on you, but they're not Jewish hermeneutic rules. They're rules, Christian hermeneutic rules. And when you trade value systems, when you accept another system for interpretation, then you will come out with that particular conclusion. But if you use the Jewish hermeneutic rules, you will come out with the truth, absolutely. Is everybody with me so far? I don't mean to be quite so emphatic against Christianity, but at the same time, we need to understand what's happened. I think it's Jeremiah. Somebody may remember better than me exactly where it's at. I think it's Jeremiah, and I think it's like 17 or 19 or something. I don't know. It says, we've inherited lies from our fathers. Somebody may remember where it's 16. At. Say it again?
16.
16 and...
16, verse 19, I believe.
Yes, thank you. Said, O Lord, my strength and my fortress, my refuge in the day of affirmations. The Gentiles will come to you from the ends of the earth and say, surely our fathers have inherited lies, worthlessness, and unprofitable things. Have you, in your journey, speaking to all of us here who probably had a little bit of a similar journey one way or another, come to the place that you say, you know what, we inherited lies from our fathers. Well, money. Money is a big thing.
Your Eminence, yes. Find it quite ironic that if Yeshua would show up today, he would be fighting the same thing he was fighting in the first century.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things I've said is that if Yeshua showed up today, would he go to church or would he go to synagogue?
How's that? Would they let him in the churches?
Let's go, let's see if I can do this in the order that I want to do it. Let's go to Romans chapter 6. Verse 14. Sin will not have dominion over you, but you're not under the law, but you're under grace. That's just New King James, just straight out of the New King James. Okay. If you read that passage the way that it is written right here, you're going to say, well, it is telling me that I'm not under the law. Okay, so now we need to interpret that statement. And one of the ways that we can interpret that statement is going to another verse in the same author, by the same author, and see what he says about this idea. So the idea was sin, and it is associated with the law. Okay, so let's say it like this. There are many ways to understand the word. In it, the Greek word is nomos. Okay, nomos is the equivalent to Torah. We could go through about two or three classes just on this particular word alone. But we'll just simplify it that it can mean also a principle. It's a teaching, many other things, but it's a principle. Okay? So, just before I move on, so we'll say for sin will not have dominion over you. You're not under the principle, or you're not under the principle, but you're under grace or chesed. Okay, so we need to define this, and we need to understand what is being said here, because it looks like he's saying you're not under the Torah anymore. Romans 8, 1 and 2 says, therefore, there's now no condemnation to those who are in Yeshua HaMashiach. How come? Because you don't walk according to your carnality or your physical desires, but you walk according to the Ruach, the Spirit. Now, let's just take the first statement and interpret it, and then we'll move on to verse 2, and then we will try to show you that what is being said here. Okay, so there's no condemnation. Now, if you ask any particular Christian about that verse, you say there's no condemnation to those who are in Yeshua HaMashiach, or Jesus Christ, as it says in your whatever. they will say that the reason that I am not being condemned or judged is because I'm in Jesus Christ. And so it's as if there is a liberty that you can do whatever you want if you are in Jesus Christ. But that is not what he's saying. He said you're not under condemnation because you are associated with Messiah, because you're obedient to his rules and laws. And it can't find condemnation on you because, oh, but that can't be. That cannot be. That, it does not work that way. Let's go to Luke chapter 1, I think it is. I'm very certain it is. Verse 5. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain Cohen named Zechariah, of the division of Abijah. So what you should notice here immediately of the division of tells you that this priesthood was set up under a order, and that came from Chronicles where King David sets up the order for the priesthood. His wife was of the daughters of Aaron. So he is a Cohen, meaning he is from Aaronic lineage. His wife is from Aaronic lineage. And her name was Elisheba. And they were both righteous before God. And they walked in all the mitzvot and ordinances of the Lord, and they were blameless. Back to Romans 8 and 2. 8, 2. Romans. So you understand that there's no condemnation, that Zechariah and Elisheba were not under condemnation because they followed all the mitzvot. Not because they were, quote, in Yeshua. Or you might try to say, oh, that was before Yeshua. Now, those that are associated with Messiah, they have a Yetzer Hara. They have an evil inclination. But it is not in control. It's necessary, but it cannot be in control. If you didn't have a Yetzer Hara, you would say, I'm not hungry. I don't need to eat. And starve yourself to death. But you know, the Yetzer Hara comes along, you know, after a few hours or minutes or whatever, however it turns out to be. But it comes along and says, you're hungry, I want something to eat. Now, look at verse 2. It said, for the law, I'm reading straight out of this version, of the spirit of life in Yeshua HaMashiach has made me free from the law of sin and death. So there's a spiritual law. That liberates you from the principle of sin and death. Or let's say it this way. If you sin, you die. Where did you hear that at before? Where do you find that principle in the Torah or in the Tanakh? In Genesis, God tells Adam, he said, if you eat of that tree, you will die. That's a principle of sin and death. So, one second. The principle as it is stated then is that if you sin, death is imminent. Okay, Don Gabriel, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to thank you for helping me clarify something I've been learning from one of the disciples of Rabbi Ginsburg. He teaches that Yeshua in his first coming was naked, which the gematria of Yeshu is equivalent to the fig tree. So in his understanding, those who are above the law was naked, like Adam and Hava, in that they had not yet received the Torah. And the challenge that Christianity has and Messianic Judaism has is they have not accepted the responsibility of sin. They want to put it off on someone else. I'm just going to thank you for helping me understand that.
Yeah, I have a difficulty there. I can understand some rudimentary idea, but I have a difficulty because, and you understand that the Torah is not the written Torah. The Torah is how God created the cosmos. And Proverbs 8 and 22 and 30 will tell you straight up, you know, I was with God. Even though it is associating it with Chokhmah, it's still the Torah. Anyway, let's move on. Okay, so there is a principle that says, you know, you cannot do that. And if we just use just a little bit of common sense, we understand that that is, in fact, a very viable principle even unto this very day. Okay, back to the fact that you have an automobile that'll do 200 on the freeway. It doesn't matter if it can do 200 on the freeway, you can't drive it that way. And if you do, there are consequences that will be. So the principle is the only way to be free of the principle is to understand that there is a mechanism in place that will cause us to understand how to conduct ourselves. Okay, so Adam and Chava are in a tree in the garden, and there's a tree. There are two trees. The first tree is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Isn't that how you always read it? Isn't that what it says? That's not what it says.
That's what we read.
That's the way it is read in your, even in a Jewish published Bible. But, say again?
Even in the Tanakh?
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, and I think we've had some of these discussions before, but even the Tanakh is not the Bible. It's Jewish published, and it's an English translation, but that is not the Bible. The Bible is the Hebrew text, Masoretic text. There's a lot to that particular statement, but I'll just leave it at that. And so in Hebrew, when it says that Adam knew Eve and she conceived, everybody understands that the word know or knowledge is associated with the idea of intimacy. Of course, enough intimacy to have a child. So what it says is that this tree that Adam consumed from this tree, he and Chava, that the tree is good married to evil. So there's a marriage of the two ideas into one concept. So there's a problem with Adam and all of his progeny because he's been infused with the confusion of that tree. Let's go to James. This will help understand both what we said about the tree, and it will illuminate what is said in Romans 8 and 2. And so, guess what? You don't have to worry about whether Hacham Shaul and Hacham Yaakov are at odds with one another. They're saying the same thing. It's just a matter of understanding. But Adam Yaakov is reiterating, okay, now, you know, don't get confused with the idea that, you know, it's grace, grace, grace. Okay? So in verse 25, chapter 1, verse 25 said, but he who looks into the Torah of perfect liberty. So the Torah is liberty. It sets you free from sin and death, the principle of sin and death. The only way to understand how to divorce good from evil is through the Torah, which has liberty. I'm going to go back in just a second, but jump down to chapter 2, verse 10. Whoever will keep the whole law and yet not stumble in one point, he is guilty of all. Absolutely. He is telling the absolute truth. And he will go on to talk about how that people think that they have a right to choose which ones they will pick and which ones they will not pick. Who gave you that right? Nobody gave you the right to pick and choose the laws that you will observe and you won't observe. You don't have that right. Back to Romans for a minute. So now that you know that the law is liberty, according to what Yaakov says, for the law of the Spirit in Yeshua HaMashiach is a law of liberty. It set me free from the principle of sin and death. How? Okay, and then you want to make sure that you understand that the spiritual law is the Torah. Does everybody understand me? Mm-hmm. So we need a reassurance that what I'm saying, that the spirit or the spiritual is the Torah. We'll just go back to verse 14 of chapter 7. For I know that the Torah is spiritual. And yes, he's saying, I have troubles with my carnality. Tell me one man who doesn't. It's not some excuse to be free from the Torah because you have difficulties in your own carnality. What's God's choice for you? What does God want you to do? Okay, go to chapter 8, 29. Chapter 8, verse 29, Romans. those he foreknew. In other words, God knew a number. We've talked about this out of Ephesians multitudes of times. He foreknew. He knew these people before. He had actually already selected them. And he was predestined. And so it was God's choice that you should conform to the image of his son. Now there's a couple of ways to read this. And it doesn't matter which way you do read it. But number one, take away all the capital letters and forget about the idea that he's talking about some deity. So we can understand that his son, who's his firstborn son? Israel. He says, turn my firstborn son loose. He speaks to Pharaoh. So if it is Hashem's will for you to conform to the image of his son, and you can read it, Yeshua. It's not that you can't read it that way, but you can read it the other way as well. And so the verse is just below that, verse 32. He did not spare his own son. He's not necessarily speaking of Yeshua. He's talking about his people, Israel. God so loved the world, the Gentile people, that what did he do? He gave them his son. What are the Jewish people? What's their job? To be kings and priests? Who are you going to be a king and priest to? Do all the other kings and priests? Or is there another group of people on the cosmos or in the cosmos that need a king and a priest? Am I making any sense?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Humanist, I have a question.
Okay.
Paul, Rav Shaul, Hakam Shaul, was not explicitly trying to say everyone was bound by the Torah. Did he not also teach that those who were not of the lost Jewish souls were not bound by the same covenant that the Jews are?
To be very honest, at this exact moment, Adon Gabriel, I don't know if I can actually answer that to your satisfaction. I would say that that is a possibility. I would say that is a possibility, but then again, I think that the reason I say that like that is because I'm so interested and engulfed in the idea of who he is trying to speak to. And so it's not that it's not possible to adhere to the seven Noahide laws, which turn into much more than that, as you've been taught. And I'm not so specifically opposed to that, but I think we have to be very careful. And I'm not saying that you're not being careful. I'm just saying that the difficulty we have is trying to sort this out today. You know, we have these preconceived notions of what we're trying to say, and sometimes some things do fit and sometimes they don't. So I'm not saying, Gabriel, I'm not saying that he didn't say things like that and he didn't believe that way. It's just not been my focus. It's very much the same way as it's not really, really been my focus to really be definitive as to the two different house idea, if you will. I don't know how else to say it. That's not been my forte. I'm not disagreeing with its possibility by any means. I'm just saying that that's not been my field of study. And so it's very much the same way here with Hacham Shaul. I'm not saying that he couldn't have said exactly what you're saying. It's just not been my focus to try to ferret that out. But it's not. It wouldn't in any way hinder my faith or whatever you want to say if he was saying that. And there is, if we're talking about the Gentiles and those that have the Nefesh Yehudi, and him being there to find them, then obviously there's a group of people that don't have the Nefesh Yehudi, and something has to happen with them. So, does that vaguely answer your question?
Well, it gets very convoluted if you try to apply all of Rav Shaul's teachings only to the lost souls within Judaism.
Yeah,
follow the Torah and the Torah's teaching that there is those who reside among Israel that do not have to follow the same halakha. And we see this in Deuteronomy, I think, 22, where it says that if there's an animal that you find that is unacceptable for Israel to eat, you can sell it to the non-Jew.
Right. And all of that becomes extremely difficult later on. But, I mean, the one thing about Rabbinic Judaism is that Rabbinic Judaism very much has the idea of an ideal Judaism. And so a lot of times when you read Talmudic passages or otherwise, you'll read what they say, but that doesn't mean that that's exactly how it was in that day. It means that, yeah, that's the goal that they're shooting for. So what I'm saying is, yeah, there are, quote, the strangers in Eretz Israel, and exactly as you said, they're not Torah observant, or they're minimally Torah observant or whatever. But, of course, by the time we get to true Rabbinic Judaism, the idea is that these people, because they live in the land, and this was what I said a couple of weeks ago, that there's a nationalism and an idea of trying to get everyone in Eretz Israel to become Jewish. So, and that, of course, is in the wake of being what? Stagnated by Shemite ideology for 50, 60 years, you know, where we can't have any association with the Gentiles. So, yeah, I agree. It's something to ferret out, but I only have so many hours in a day. Okay, let's try to go. We'll try to sum up a little bit here. We've gone on a wild goose chase, and I hope it's put some ideas in your mind to where you understand some things. Okay, to the book of Matthew. I'll get this chapter right. Chapter 7. He says, verse 23, then I will declare to them. So he's talking about some that are, you can back up, and it said, he's talking about the day of judgment. Verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven. That needs a lot of deciphering. But he does the will of my Father in heaven. So, in other words, in order to understand the kingdom, you have to understand the halakhic understanding of the court system. Okay? And many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, and we have not prophesied in your name and cast out demons in your name and done many wonders in your name. And he said, then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. So the word here is anomos, and it means to be without the Torah and or in opposition to the Torah. Now, I'm not saying that everybody on the planet is, you know, go straight to hell, don't collect $200, don't whatever, but I am telling you that it right here, he's saying that here is a group of people that are opposed to the Torah or without the Torah. And they think they know who he is. And they try to, quote, cast out devils in his name, but they don't. He doesn't know them, and that's because they don't follow his lifestyle or his rules. Now, I want to say, basically, there's a lot more to this discussion, and we're out of time already. But one thing I want you to understand, and I hope this has not been a difficulty for you, but if it is, I can understand that. At first, many years ago, I had the same difficulty, but I didn't know the boundaries, I didn't know the limits, I didn't understand. And as we grow in our understanding and as we grow in our awareness of how things were, we can begin to come to some conclusions that others don't understand, and this is it has a great deal to do with their fear. Now, I try to use more than one word with regards to the Chachamim, the sages or the rabbis. Okay, so there are several different words, and we should understand that Judaism, by and large, and I think that Yeshua relates directly to this when he talks about the children of the bride, and the children of the bride and the bridegroom, etc. All of this is relation to Challah, which is the bride, which is the most intelligent of the Jewish people. So, let me say it like this. There are people who are aware of deep spiritual truths in the Torah that are not specifically called rabbis. But are they sages? Are they scholars? Are they people of wisdom? Absolutely. So I say that all of you have a level of education now that perhaps you didn't have a year ago, and so you're closer to being and are a sage in many respects to the things that you've learned. You can explain them to people, and even though it can be a very, very difficult job, you understand why you should follow and or practice this way. So becoming a scholar, it's not everybody's job, it's not everybody's duty, but what I say is that I don't care if you don't want to be a Torah scholar. I don't care. As Eminence might put it differently and say, it's your job to become a Torah scholar. And in essence, I think that it will happen according to what the sages say. You start it here, and then you'll finish it in the Yemot HaMashiach, the days of Messiah. But it is our duty to at least study the Torah. Maybe not as much as the next guy who is a scholar, but you have an obligation to do some. We read every Sunday morning the opening prayer that that says that there's no maximum amount of Torah that you're commanded to study. So, becoming a scholar, becoming a sage, becoming a hacham, becoming a rabbi, those things are important. I think they're very important. But I'm not going to be somebody that sits there with a 100-question quiz and say, okay, let's see how much Torah you know. That is not my goal. So let me conclude, I guess, and say many things have been said in negativity from Chacham Shaul's writings. And I, in many respects, I feel very alone in the way that I translate and comment on Chacham Shaul's work and Chacham Tzofet and Yahu is coming, etc. But I think that even just a few of the things that we said tonight, when they're considered, you can see that they really didn't think that we should eject the Torah and go for grace. And it's very interesting that you ask any Jewish person about the Torah and the giving of the Torah, and he will tell you that it's Matan Torah. It is a gift. And many years ago, I did not understand this. I couldn't even fathom it. But now I can fathom not existing without this gift. And having a devotion personally, my personal devotion, to study it, dissect it, and try to figure out, was the Nazarene Kosher really against it? Or is there another way of seeing this? And this is what I said to you earlier, that you have to abandon Christian hermeneutics. And if you don't abandon Christian hermeneutics, you will continuously come up with the same thing. If you accept Jewish hermeneutic rules and laws, then guess what you're going to come up with? I've said it, my frustration is with my Jewish brothers, because they keep practicing Christian hermeneutics on a Jewish piece of text. Someone needs to slap them on the back of the hand and say, cut it out. So, the Torah is a very, very spiritual thing, and it frees us from
the
principle of sin and death. And the only way we can understand how to resolve the problems that we have being the progeny of Adam and Chava is to use the Torah, which tells us what is right and what is wrong. Instead of saying we have good married to evil or right married to wrong, that leaves you in a state of absolute confusion. So the only way to get rid of the confusion is to read what is right and what is wrong in the Torah. But
And use logic,
which I was about to say, that it doesn't take having a rule written on a board somewhere to say don't throw trash in your neighbor's yard. Really would like to say it doesn't even sound logical to throw it out the window when you're going down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we find two heroes in Luke. When we read, and they were both righteous before God, and they walked in all of the commandments and the ordinances. Now, ordinances are chukim or chukot, which mean
they don't make sense
to us in our mind. We can't rationalize why we have to have a blue fringe on a corner of our garment. And before the Lord, they were blameless. But of course, you know, and as soon as Yeshua dies and is resurrected, they're condemned to hell. Right? That's Christian ideology. It's not Jewish ideology, but that's Christian ideology.